Welcome to the Universal Podcast Network. One voice, everywhere.
Let's do this. Right. Definitely. Hi, I'm Daniel Lickers.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is great at empower music itself, and legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another great episode. The nostalgia engine, why clarity without performance requires foundation in the past, part one.
Yes, indeed. This is a moment and familiar to almost anyone who has ever loved music when a song from another era comes on and something in the chest unlocks. It might be a guitar chord, a vocal phrasing, or a specific drum sound. Suddenly, you are not where you are. You are somewhere else, or with someone special, or someone you were never actually alive to witness, but feel with irrational certainty that you remember. This is a peculiar spell of musical nostalgia. It does not merely recall the past, it reconstructs it, and in the reconstructing, makes it more vivid than the present. In conclusion, this reflection is about that phenomenon, about why music from the 1950s to the 1970s keeps cycling back into cultural consciousness, how those revivals happen, what they reveal about human memory and collective longing, and why, no matter how thoroughly any era seems to have been left behind, the wheel always eventually turns back around.
Before we get into the history, Mr. Ming, I want to start with the concept itself. We use the word nostalgia pretty casually, but it's actually the right word for what happens when an old song connects with a new audience. And why does music, well, trigger it so powerfully?
That's the right place to start because the word has a genuinely interesting origin. Nostalgia was coined in 1688 by the Swiss physician Johannes Hofer. He combined the Greek nostos, meaning homecoming, with algos, meaning pain. He was describing soldiers who became physically ill when longing for home. It was understood as a medical condition, not a pleasant feeling at all. The transformation of nostalgia from pathology to pleasure is itself a cultural story worth telling. What we're talking about music specifically, the research gets fascinating. Neuroscientists like Stefan Kolsch at the University of Bergen have documented that music activates the limbic system, the brain's emotional and memory center, more directly than almost any other sensory input. David Huron's landmark work, Sweet Anticipation, argues that music is essentially a prediction machine. It sets up expectations and then plays with them. And every time those expectations are fulfilled or subverted, the brain releases dopamine. When a song is familiar, particularly one you heard in youth, it brings a double reward. The pleasure of the music itself and the rush of autobiographical memory attached to it. But here's the twist that matters for our conversation today. You do not have to have lived through an era to feel nostalgic for it. Researchers call this phenomenon armchair nostalgia, or more recently, historical nostalgia. If you grew up in the 1990s listening to your parents' Motown records or discover the Beatles at 14 through a film score, you can feel profound longing for a 1964 you never inhabited. The past becomes a kind of emotional landscape anyone can access if the music is good enough, Matt. So nostalgia isn't just memory, it's imagination wearing memory's clothes, and that's precisely what makes it such a powerful engine for musical revival. An artist in 2010 who reaches for a 1960s soul sound isn't just being derivative, they're offering their audience an emotional passport to a time that feels simpler, warmer, more authentic, even if it wasn't any of those things in reality. Frederick Jameson, the cultural critic, had a more cynical reading in his 1991 book, Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism. He called nostalgia culture a form of cultural cannibalism, consuming the past because the present no longer knows how to generate authentic style. I find that a bit harsh, but there's something real to it. The question is always, when an era comes back, are artists genuinely drawing creative sustenance from it, or are they simply raiding the archive because originality is expensive and familiarity sells? How do we tell the difference? Time, usually. The revivals that last, that actually enrich the culture, tend to involve artists who absorb the old vocabulary and then speak something new with it. Amy Winehouse didn't just imitate 1960s girl group soul. She ran her own very contemporary pain through those musical structures and produced something that sounded classic and original simultaneously. The revivals that don't last are the purely decorative ones, all the sonic signifiers with none of the underlying emotional truth. Revivals often make strange bedfellows with subsequent ages. For example, the gay 90s revival, between World War I, the influenza pandemic, and the Great Depression, the beginning of the 20th century was characterized by deadly societal upheaval. Because of that, many people long for the simple era before all this began, namely the 1890s. From the 1920s to the 1950s, the popular culture of this decade, affectionately referred to as the gay 90s, was very popular. Weekly radio programs exclusively played hits of the day, many Hollywood pictures focused on the era, and record labels released popular compilations of songs written in that era. Many of those mighty mold old chestnuts from the 1890s have proven quite durable. In one particular genre, ragtime was released during the 19th century's final decade. Revivals can be strangely out of place, for example, the ragtime revival. Ragtime is a syncopated style of piano music that found great popularity in the late 1800s and early 1900s, with popular compositions like Maple Leaf Rag and The Entertainer. Scott Joplin was the king of the genre. Ragtime came to an end with the pianist's untimely death in 1917. Then he was largely forgotten for decades. Unlikely as it sounds, ragtime roared back in 1970 when pianist Joshua Rifkin recorded an album of Joplin's compositions. The album sold over 100,000 copies in the first year and set off a short-lived ragtime revival. Scholars, Harold C. Schoenberg wrote in the New York Times after seeing Rifkin performed in 1971, are going to have to get busy on Joplin. And busy they did get. Not only did critical interest in Joplin grow, but his compositions also featured prominently in the Oscar-winning soundtrack for the 1973 box office smash hit, The Sting. In fact, Marvin Hamlisch's recording of Joplin's The Entertainer for the soundtrack climbed all the way to number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100. It sadly could not get past Ray Stevens' The Streak or the Jackson 5's Dancing Machine. The ragtime Joplin revival is actually quite bizarre, since in the 1970s pop scene, few would be able to realistically relate to early 20th century New Orleans bordello life, the origins of ragtime. These earlier musical revivals are a good reminder that nostalgia is not new. We've been reviving sounds for at least the last century. In that sense, it's not that strange that people are still listening to music from the 1960s today. The Beatles are solidly in place at 150 or so of the top acts on Spotify. Even so, it's important to remind people that the scale of that listening is very small. In 2024, Luminate reported that 0.7% of streams were of music from the 1960s. Nearly 90% of the streams were on music released after the year 2000. In other words, people are mostly listening to recent hits. You might notice that there is a clear difference between our current musical nostalgia and that which came before, though. When ragtime, music hall, or any other musical style were revived during the 20th century, new songs were being made in those styles rather than people listening to the original recordings. This is the case with nearly every revival of the 20th century. The original recordings of the music being revived would have sounded very old. That's not the case anymore. Since the middle of the 1960s, recording fidelity hasn't changed that much. A song released in 1982, for example, might sound dated because of the production choices, but the actual quality of the recording won't be much different than something made today. Some artists have opted for a more classic sound that harkens back to the 1980s and 1990s. Chandler Walters is one of those artists with that throwback sound. His single, Break Your Heart, mixes a song that could be from the George Strait songbook with a bit more edge. Chris DiBella longs for the 1980s and tasty solos. So much of the pop universe is driven by vocalists that I think some musical breaks could go a long way. Olivia Newton-John's smash Physical is a good example of this. Though it rocks a bit more than your average pop record, it's still certainly a pop record. and it's got a nice guitar. He's just playing to the song. In conclusion, musical nostalgia is not merely sentimental backward-looking, but a neurologically real phenomenon that allows audiences across generations to access emotional meaning from eras they may never have directly lived, and it provides the cultural fuel for every major musical revival the 20th century has produced.
Mr. Mink, let's go to the beginning, or at least the beginning of the era we're focusing on. The 1950s produced rock and roll, but by the late 1960s, were people already feeling nostalgic for it?
Almost immediately, and this is important, rock and roll was barely a decade old before people were treating it as a lost golden age. You have to understand how fast the culture moved in that period. In 1955, Bill Haley and his Comets released Rock Around the Clock, and it was a genuine cultural explosion. Within 3 years, Elvis had been drafted into the Army, Buddy Holly was dead, Chuck Berry was in legal trouble, and Little Richard had temporarily quit rock and roll for the church. The originals had scattered. What replaced them, at least in the early 1960s American market, was a significantly softer, more polished, more commercially managed version of the form. Frankie Avalon, Fabian, Bobby V, nice guys, good-looking, perfectly calibrated for teenage consumption. But for anyone who remembered the dangerous electricity of the original wave, it felt like a delusion. So nostalgia for rock and roll's origins set in while rock and roll was still a teenager itself. The 1950s were in vogue during much of the 1970s. Most people point to television shows like Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley, and films like Grease and American Graffiti when discussing this nostalgia, but it is also readily apparent in music. Nostalgic acts like Sha-na-na kicked off a revival, shockingly even appearing at Woodstock. Many 1950s hitmakers like Neil Sedaka and Chuck Berry also found themselves at the top of the charts again. The nostalgia trend was recurring. Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll was released in 1971, and that set up Grease. Grease opened up on Broadway in 1971. It was written by Jim Jacobs and Warren Casey, both of whom grew up in 1950s Chicago and were already in their 20s, homesick for their adolescence. The 1978 film starring John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John became one of the highest-grossing musicals of all time and triggered what music historians like Peter Wick, in his essential survey, Rock Music, Culture, Aesthetics, and Sociology, describe as the first fully commercial packaging of a rock revival. Suddenly, the 1950s aesthetic was everywhere. Poodle skirts, pompadours, diner culture, and sanitized version of the original records. The film's original songs by Barry Gibb of the Bee Gees and others were written in the 1970s, but deliberately composed to sound like the 1950s. You're the One That I Want has a melodic phrasing and structural simplicity of a late 50s pop song wrapped in 1970s production gloss. It's a deliberate attempt of temporal transportation, and it worked spectacularly. Even in 1961 and 1962, American teenagers were already romanticizing a sound that was only 5 or 6 years old. And then something remarkable happens. George Lucas captures that exact moment in American Graffiti, a film set in 1962 that is essentially one long act of cultural mourning. Lucas was born in 1944. He was a teenager during exactly this transitional period, and the film's soundtrack is almost entirely early rock and roll. The film made over $100 million on a budget of around $700,000. It was a blockbuster, nostalgic machine, and it told Hollywood something crucial. People would pay to wallow in the recent past. Original rock and roll was really as dangerous as people remember. It was genuinely dangerous in specific, historically measurable ways. In the Democratic Party American South, integrated audiences at rock and roll shows violated segregation laws. Ike Turner, whose Rocket 88 from 1951 is often cited by music historians, including Robert Palmer and Deep Blues, as the first rock and roll record, was performing music that crossed racial lines that society was violently enforcing. Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode, with its lyric about a country boy who could play the guitar, was coded with class aspiration and youth defiance. Nostalgia was king, as exemplified by the song's central place in the film Back to the Future, along with the Penguins' Earth Angel. When 1970s revivalists called the 1950s, they were, consciously or not, softening confrontational political edges. much of this nostalgia would only grow stronger at the beginning of the 1980s. Queen would top the charts with an Elvis Presley-inspired tune, Crazy Little Thing Called Love. The Stray Cats would score multiple hits the year after with an exceedingly retro sound. If it wasn't for the Brian Setzer of the Stray Cats to push rockabilly back into the mainstream, the guitar savant felt the need to bring swing, a genre that died in the 1940s, back in the 1990s. Along with Brian Setzer, groups like Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, Squirrel Nut Zippers, and the Cherry Poppin' Daddies were selling millions of records, scoring legitimate hits, and playing the Super Bowl. Advertisements and films even came to rely on the genre. And in this case, nobody, for example, in the 1990s was listening to Louis Prima's original recording of Jump, Jive, and Wail. They were listening to Brian Setzer's cover. The 1960s might be the decade associated with more revolutionary popular music than any other. Throughout the decade, the influence of music hall, the British equivalent of vaudeville in the United States, was everywhere. Multiple number one hits, including Herman Hermit's I'm Henry VIII, I Am, and the new vaudeville band's Winchester Cathedral, pulled heavily from this early 20th century tradition. The Beatles' Paul McCartney was especially influenced by the 60-year-old music, When I'm 64, Honey Pie, and Maxwell's Silver Hammer, among others, lean on musical hall tropes. In conclusion, the first great rock and roll revival began astonishingly early, before the decade that produced it had even fully passed, and established a template for every commercial music revival that followed. Selectivity about what to remember, softening of political edges, and the powerful emotional transaction between artists who knew the original and audiences longing for a past they only partly understood.
Mr. Mick, now I want to talk about something that I think it's, well, underappreciated. When the Beatles and the Rolling Stones arrived in America in 1964, the popular narrative was us that they were bringing something entirely new. But that's not quite right, is it?
It is perhaps the greatest irony in the history of popular music. The British invasion of 1964 and 1966 is remembered as a revolution, and in terms of cultural impact, it absolutely was. But musically, it was in large part a revival of American rhythm and blues, rock and roll, and early soul. The Beatles learned to play by covering Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Carl Perkins, and the Everly Brothers. Their early live sets were essentially an American roots music tutorial. Twist and Shout is a cover of a Burt Burns and Phil Medley composition, originally recorded by the Top Notes in 1961, and most memorably by the Isley Brothers. The Beatles recorded it in one take at the end of a marathon session. John Lennon's voice was already shot after recording earlier all day, and it produced what many consider the greatest cover recording in rock history. Interesting by hindsight, at the time, I preferred the Isleys. In any case, British teenagers were the ones keeping American music alive. This is a well-documented cultural paradox. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, American radio was dominated by the clean teen pop that replaced original rock and roll. But in Britain, a small network of obsessive young men, many of them like Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Jimmy Page, and Eric Clapton, living in the south of England, were mail-ordering records from American labels like Chess, Stax, and Sun. They were studying Robert Johnson, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and Bo Diddley with the fervor of seminarians. The great British music journalist Nick Cohn, in his book, 1969, describes this as almost a scholarly discipline. These boys were archivists as much as musicians. When the Rolling Stones covered Muddy Waters' I Just Want to Make Love to You, and it introduced American audiences to the original through the back door of a British cover, it had an extraordinary effect. It sent Americans back to their own music. Muddy Waters himself reportedly said that it was the Rolling Stones, who named themselves after his song, Rolling Stone, who finally got more Americans to pay attention to his work. This tells us something about nostalgia and revival actually function. It tells us something counterintuitive and important. Sometimes a culture needs an outsider to remind it of its own inheritance. The British musicians were not nostalgic for the American South in any personal sense. They had no biographical connection to it, but they had the distance to hear the music without the social baggage attached to it in America. They heard it as art, not as race music or working class entertainment or moral threat. That distance allowed them to perceive its quality clearly and to present it to a new audience with fresh urgency. This pattern repeats. When hip-hop producers in the 1990s began sampling James Brown and Parliament Funkadelic, they were performing a similar archival act, lifting recordings that had been commercially marginalized and returning them to mainstream consciousness. When Jack White's formed the White Stripes in 1999 and rooted his entire aesthetic in the Delta blues and early rock and roll, he was doing what the Stones had done three decades earlier, recovering an American inheritance and repackaging it with an outsider's devotion. The Beatles evolved so rapidly. By 1966, they were making Revolver and Sgt. Pepper's, and that evolution itself is a form of nostalgia. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is, among other things, a nostalgia trip. It's explicitly framed as a performance by a fictional vintage band, the kind you'd see at a British seaside fair or music hall. Paul McCartney has said in multiple interviews, most comprehensively in the Mark Levinson edited documentation, The Beatles Recording Sessions, that the Peppers concept came partly from his love of Edwardian music hall entertainment, a form that was already 50 years old when he was a boy. When I'm 64 is a music hall pastiche McCartney wrote as a teenager, and its inclusion on Sgt. Pepper's is a nostalgic gesture embedded inside one of the most forward-looking albums ever made. The Beatles were simultaneously the most progressive and the most nostalgic band of their era, a contradiction they wore without apparent discomfort. In conclusion, the British invasion was less a musical revolution than a transatlantic act of cultural recovery. British musicians loving American music back to life and returning it to American shores, transformed but essentially faithful, demonstrating that the most powerful revivals are often carried out by enthusiastic outsiders with nothing to lose and everything to love.
So, Mr. Mank, as we wrap up part one, we can talk about this period without talking about Motown and soul music. And I want to talk about not just the original, but why these sounds keep coming back and what is about soul music specifically that makes it so recyclable.
The word I'd use is not recyclable, I'd say renewable. Soul music keeps coming back because it's rooted in emotional fundamentals that do not date. Longing, joy, heartbreak, community, and the body's desire to move. The scholars who've written most persuasively about this, Nelson George in The Death of Rhythm and Blues, and Craig Werner in The Change is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America, both argue that soul music is not a genre so much as an approach, a way of investing popular song with the full weight of lived human experience. You can wrap that approach in any production style from any decade, and it will still communicate. Berry Gordy founded Motown Records in Detroit in 1959 with an $800 loan from his family's savings club. His genius was assembling an extraordinary in-house operation. Songwriters like Holland Dozier Holland, producers like Norman Whitfield, session musicians collectively known as the Funk Brothers, and creating a sound that was simultaneously rooted in gospel and rhythm and blues tradition and accessible to a broad pop audience. Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine, The Supremes' You Can't Hurry Love, and The Four Tops' Reach Out, I'll Be There, achieved something rare. They were both artistically serious and genuinely popular without compromise in either direction. The first major wave of Motown nostalgia arrived in late 1970s and early 1980s, and it was at least partially driven by the backlash against disco. When disco collapsed commercially and culturally around 1979-1980, there was a broad reappraisal of soul music's earlier, earthier forms. Radio programmers began calling it classic soul, itself a nostalgic framing, and stations dedicated to the format appeared across America. The 1982 film, The Big Chill, directed by Lawrence Kasdan, was perhaps the most culturally influential act of Motown revival outside of music itself. The soundtrack, featuring Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine, The Rolling Stones' You Can't Always Get What You Want, and Aretha Franklin's You Make Me Feel a Natural Woman, sold over 2 million copies and reintroduced those recordings to an entirely new generation that had been in grade school when they were first released. Aretha Franklin is often mentioned in the same breath as Motown, but she wasn't Motown. She was Atlantic Records. Yes, and the distinction matters. Aretha Franklin's classic recordings, Respect, Chain of Fools, Think, were made for Atlantic Records on the production of Jerry Wexler, and they represented a raw, less polished form of soul than the Motown sound. If Motown was pop soul, highly crafted, meticulously arranged for broad audience appeal, then Atlantic soul was grittier and more confrontational. Respect, which Aretha Franklin transformed an Otis Redding song about a man asking for domestic deference into a declaration of female pride, is one of the most instructive examples in pop history of how a cover can improve and funk up the original. Redding himself reportedly said he lost his song when Aretha got hold of it, and he meant it as a compliment. And this soul tradition keeps returning. We see it in the 2000s with Amy Winehouse. She is the textbook case. Back to Black, produced by Mark Ronson, is one of the most sophisticated acts of musical revival of any 21st century, precisely because Winehouse and Ronson understood what they were doing. They did not just sample or pastiche the girl group and the Brill-building sound of the early 1960s. They absorbed its production philosophy. The use of live drums played as an old mono era, the horn arrangements drawn directly from vintage Muscle Shoals and Stax recordings, the deliberate avoidance of digital sonic tricks, all of it was an act of principled homage. The great paradox of Back to Black is that it sounds more like 1965 than anything recorded in 1965 sounds today, because we hear 1965 recordings through decades of accumulated context. Winehouse and Ronson gave us 1965 in high definition, with all the emotional immediacy restored. Bruno Mars carried this tradition forward with deliberate craft. His 2016 album, 24K Magic, drew directly on 1980s funk and soul, the Minneapolis sound of Prince, the Gap Band excess of Rick James, but his 2021 collaboration with Anderson .Paak as Silk Sonic and Evening with Silk Sonic went back further, the 1970s soul and R&B. Leave the Door Open is so meticulously aligned with the Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson tradition that it functions almost as if a musicological demonstration as well as a hit record. In conclusion, soul and Motown represent a strand of popular music so emotionally fundamental, rooted in the body, in community, in the full spectrum of human longing, that it does not so much return periodically as simply continue underground, reemerging whenever popular culture is ready to hear again its particular truth.
Well done, Mr. Mack. In part one of this nostalgia engine, we explore why truly clarity cannot be manufactured for attention or trade by the pressure to perform. By revisiting the memories, experiences, and lessons that form us, we uncover a stable foundation for understanding who we are today. So, Mr. Mack, would you like to plug in something?
I appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, Grow the Business. Connect with me on LinkedIn. G. Mack, the Dr. Digital Smith, PhD. Listen to the Dr. Digital podcast. Pick up a couple of volumes I have on Amazon. That's On Track, Ian Hunter, and Burning America. And if you like music, listen to True Fans and support them.
Indeed, people, let's support Mr. Mack, the Dr. Digital, and of course, our four podcasts that we are doing under the Universal Podcast Network: Music 101, Sex 101, Mental Health 101, and Love Letters. So, Mr. Mack, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Till next time, Deus Vault.
Morning, people. See you soon.
Thank you for joining us on the Universal Podcast Network. One voice, everywhere.